All right, folks, strap in and hold on. We're going zero G here on this episode of This Week in Law. Mike Keyes is not here, but he's loaned us one of his lawyers from the Dorsey firm in Seattle. That is Stefan Spida. He is a great guest joining us today, along with my other co-host, Matt Curtis. We have Kim Ellis joining us. She's the founder and director of Earth Space Tech in Australia. She's a lawyer. She's a space policy analyst. And we are going deep on space law today. I think you're going to love it.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Matt Curtis, and Mike Keyes. Episode 425, recorded June 8th, 2018. 21st Century Prime Directive. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell. Thank you so much for joining us today on This Week in Law. We're thrilled to be here. We've got an interesting and exciting show for you. Wonderful panelists with me today. I'd like to introduce you or reintroduce you to Matt Curtis, my co-host. Hi, Matt. How are you doing?
Hi. Great to be back on again and ready to go to space today. This is going to be an exciting show.
I know. I'm ready to blast off, too. Matt is referring to the fact that one of our guests today is the founder and director of Earth Space Tech in Australia. Her name is Kim Ellis. She's a lawyer and a professor at International Space University in France. And just as with true space exploration, we've been trying to figure out how best to communicate with her today. Our regular channel of communication being Skype is proving unreliable over the miles. So we are attempting to patch her in on the phone, and we'll get her on just as soon as we can. So we're excited for Kim to join us. I'm also very excited. You'll notice that my other co-host, Mike Keyes, is not with us here today, but he has sent us one of his colleagues. Stefan Spida is here with us today. He's also a lawyer at Dorsey in Seattle, where he's a recent addition to their office, and he's working with Mike. And it's really nice to have you here, Stefan. We're so glad you could join us.
Thanks for having me.
Stefan does patent and trademark work there, as well as copyright and trade secrets. And in prepping for the show today, we've all, you know, been delving into our future careers as space lawyers. So, you know, there's no pigeonholing any lawyer as far as I can tell. But you're primarily in the patent and trademark realm, trade secret realm.
That's right. Yeah.
Cool. All right. So that's actually where we're going to start the show before we delve into our space stories. Stefan publishes, along with Mike and many of their colleagues at Dorsey, at Dorsey's great blog, which is called the TMCA. We feature a lot of Mike's stories there. And this week, we're going to feature a couple of Stefan's. And the first one has to do with a topic that we come back to repeatedly, and that is how so many patent cases wind up in the Eastern District of Texas, and how the selection of the court for patent cases comes about. So let's talk about that first. Stefan, tell us about your piece on the blog. It's called Home is Where the Principal Place of Business Is.
Sure. So the piece is called, as you said, Home is Where the Principal Place of Business Is. And the idea there was that this rather narrow federal circuit decision addressed the situation where you've got a state that has multiple judicial districts and you're trying to decide which of those judicial districts is proper for venue. The way this came up in this particular case was two different suits were pending in the Eastern District of Texas, and the defendants sought mandamus relief because they didn't think they belonged in the Eastern District of Texas, and Judge Gilstrap disagreed. And the issue really came down to whether or not they were considered resident in every district in the state of Texas based on having a place of business in the other districts, or whether they were limited to the districts in which they had their principal place of business. And this narrow decision decided that you are only a resident of the district in which your principal place of business is, and not in every judicial district in that state.
Wow, that's a fascinating decision. Did the federal circuit struggle at all in its analysis with the fact that it's getting harder and harder to decide where companies do business now?
Yes, there was some discussion of that. First of all, I'll take a step back and say that this decision was quite short for how much analysis there was of both sort of the language of the statute, the history of the statute, the purpose of the statute, and the relevant precedent. So in reading the decision, you might get the impression almost of an impatient set of judges writing this. So that was something that stood out to me. And they did address this sort of question that you raised, and that sort of fell under the auspices of the sort of modern business reality. And is it really possible to determine what the principal place of business is? And they dealt with it in pretty summary fashion and dismissed that question pretty quickly.
Did they just decide if you have a physical address, or what is the touchstone for that these days?
Well, so that's a slightly different issue. So that under the venue statute, you've got where are you located and performing infringing acts. Like, for example, if you've got a store and you're selling in the Eastern District of Texas, that's a separate inquiry under the venue statute from, do you have a principal place of business there? That's a separate prong of the venue statute. Mm-hmm. So they didn't need to grapple with that particular one in this decision with the level of detail that I think you're asking about.
Yeah. Matt, you noticed an interesting stat in Stefan's piece. What was that?
Yeah, so I think it was, I don't remember what the number was before, but it was upwards, I think I want to say 40% of patent
45.
Cases. 45% of patent cases were going through the Eastern District of Texas, and now it's down in the teens, which seems to have accomplished what many people were worried about, that number going through there and the sort of at least on appearances the filers' friendliness in the rulings, that number has dropped off. And essentially what you're doing is you're dispersing the judgments at a district court level throughout the United States. You should get, in terms of your quality of opinion, you're going to get different judges writing different opinions, which should aggregate into more decisions that the federal circuit has to sort through. But also, just a reminder that the Eastern District of Texas is a very small town that has built up quite a revenue stream on patent litigants coming in. I think the iconic image is the Samsung ice skating rink right across the street from the courthouse. So I think that before this, they were worried about running out of jurors who hadn't served in 3 years or something like that. So, that was a big case, the TC Heartland case last year. So it's actually kind of amazing how much that precipitated a drop in the percentage of cases.
Yeah, it really is. We have Kim Ellis on with us. Hi, Kim. I'm so glad that we were able to get you on by phone. We were saying that just as with actual space exploration, sometimes you have to work with the tools you have just to make sure that the communication happens.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I'm delighted to be on, Denise. Thanks so much. I've restarted and redone all of the tech, as they say, turn all the electrons off and then switch them all back on again. And luckily the telephone line is working just fine.
Yay, good old analog phone technology saves the day. We started discussing one of our non-space stories, and I'll just add, and then we're going to delve into the fascinating realm of space law with you, Kim. But before we do that, I just want to wrap up what we kicked off the show with here. Stefan, is there any final takeaway that we should ponder as we consider what happened in InRay Big Commerce Inc.?
I'll go back to saying that this is a fairly narrow incremental addition to the jurisprudence that follows TC Heartland. So I think this particular decision addressed really whether or not a company that has, for example, its principal place of business in the Northern District of Texas, whether venue is proper as a result in the Eastern District of Texas. So I think that narrow question is now resolved. I would instead encourage people to continue to look for more ambiguity that remains in the statute and look for additional Federal Circuit precedent on those issues as the full breadth of TC Heartland is implemented by the Federal Circuit. So I think it's more I think of this as a narrow incremental addition that suggests there may be more. And then, you know, maybe in the next couple of years, we'll have a complete picture on what TC Heartland really meant for the statute and for patent litigation in Texas and in other districts.
Right. And I guess that's my final question on the topic for you. Is there any opportunity under the statute and under the incremental cases that are coming out interpreting it for someone to give Eastern District of Texas a run for their money and decide, hey, we want the Samsung ice rink across from the courthouse and we'd like to tailor our district to be the next home of patent litigation? I presume that the goal is to have that not happen, but do you think there's a way for someone to end run that?
Well, I think a lot of people have been noting the uptick in Delaware, and I think Delaware is a more natural place for some of this litigation. It's closer to major population centers. Most companies are incorporated there. And I think it's gotten to the point now, I think this is still going on, where they've got judges coming in from Philadelphia to kind of take up some of this extra work that's been going on in Delaware. So I think a lot of people have noted, uptick in Delaware, and I think that's kind of the natural next venue. Others, I believe, have tried. I think the Eastern District of Virginia for a while had this reputation as a rocket docket. I don't know that it would satisfy the new conditions in the same way that Delaware would, given that if you're incorporated in Delaware, then you can be sued there. So I think I think Delaware is the one to watch, basically.
Okay, good to know. We will definitely do that. And I am so excited that you just used the term rocket docket.
good transition.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you for our non-lawyers in the room with us here today as we do This Week in Law. Is a rocket docket is just one that cranks cases through quickly. Some courts are slower than others in processing their caseloads. Some are very fast. And so, of course, we want to be your rocket docket today. Not that we want to do anything quickly, because we thankfully have this nice long block of time wherein we do our show. But we want to talk about space law, and maybe we'll even talk about whether there will be a place where many space law disputes, once they begin to manifest themselves, get litigated, as there has been in the patent arena. I mentioned we have Kim Ellis on the phone with us today. We don't have her video. She is the founder and director of Earth Space Tech in Australia, lawyer and adjunct professor at the International Space University in Strasbourg, France, and thinker of all things space law and policy. So we're going to delve right into a bunch of topics along those lines. Kim, how did you get into this?
So that's a really interesting question. My career started with BHP Billiton, which, as you know, is one of the world's biggest mining companies. And I started as a research scientist as an industrial chemist of all things. And I worked with them before I had children and then after I had children. And then the company restructured and I found myself looking for a new career. And so I went along and decided that because I'd been a closet space nerd for my entire life, I decided to let the world know that I loved rockets and I loved space, and I just started moving forward. And I won an Australian award to go work over in the US at the Kennedy Space Center with the International Space University, and I've studied at the Space University as a student, as well as becoming one of the adjunct faculty members there. It seems like every step of the way I've had like a little help. I don't know where from, but it's been such a great and exciting road.
That's fantastic. Well, we're so so excited that the road has led you here to us today. And we are all closet, probably lifelong space nerds here. I think I could speak for our entire This Week in Tech organization when I say that. And I think I probably could speak for our entire audience who tunes in to our show every week. Probably for our whole panel today. So we're really excited.
I was going to say, sorry to interrupt. You just have to stand up and say, I love space, and not be afraid. Someone will call you a nerd, but that's okay.
Yep, absolutely. So you're among nerd friends. let's start out. I think a logical place to start is to start talking about whether there's law that governs the activities in space that we do now and the activities in space that we know people are forging ahead toward, whether it's Elon Musk and SpaceX or various other private enterprises. That we're going to get into some of the specific areas that we think will likely be next for space exploration and exploitation. But we do have some legal framework. We have a 51-year-old treaty called the Outer Space Treaty. We have a slightly less old treaty called the Moon Treaty. And then here in the United States, we've been trying to encourage more private investment in space exploration, most recently through something called the Space Free Enterprise Bill. Do you want to tell us about the interplay between those things and what the current legal framework looks like?
So the Outer Space Treaty that you just mentioned, it's like you say, it's 51 years old. And if you can imagine getting, you know, every country to the table to agree on a bunch of stuff as they did 51 years ago, it's kind of like getting a bunch of toddlers to all do the one thing at the same time, if you know what I mean. It's just really hard. So the treaty's been in action for a really long time, and luckily there's been peaceful activities in space for that period of time. So when you look forward with what you said about what's coming up next, I think that's a good point for me to add in there that the space industry is really highly technically focused. You have so many different bits of technology that you have to try and manage, and manage the responsibilities and obligations that are outlined under the treaty. So when we're moving forwards to think about what's going to happen next, you're trying to manage the intersection of law with technology of a bunch of technologies that, as you just said, are moving fast exponentially quickly, that it's really hard for law to catch up. And as you know, law is always catching up to what's happening in society. But in this particular area, it's really hard to catch up. And so we've seen the introduction of a bunch of new legislation, just like this I can't remember the exact name, the Free Enterprise bill that just went through the US Congress. So I think that moving forwards, there's going to be a lot more use of the word of adaptive governance, which is creating sets of regulations that can be changed stepwise as technology changes. Does that make sense?
It does, yes. So I think that the takeaway I get from everything I've read and getting ready for today's show and from what you're telling us now is that we have some overarching, very broad, very vague principles that have agreed to internationally. And they were never designed, nor are they equipped to deal with the vast majority of specific situations that arise.
Oh, absolutely. You've got such a good point there, because 51 years ago, who would have imagined, you know, the way that we're able to make calls, video calls, you know, even being able to send signals the way that we do. Being able to strap a car to a rocket and send it into space, it's just, they're all things that nobody really imagined at that time. And so it's, you're absolutely right. That framework is a framework that everybody else builds their national space regulations onto.
Mm-hmm. Matt Curtis is on the panel with us here today, and unfortunately, Matt's going to need to run in a little while. So I want to give you some time, Matt, to discuss with Kim before you have to go, either the overarching legal structure such as it is, or anything else really in our space rundown here that was really making you intrigued.
Yeah, I think the most intriguing thing is like your basic property right principles of like how do you acquire property rights in space. So it seems like if we send up a satellite up there, the property rights remain, but at some point the asset is going to depreciate and it's going to stay there. So there's like, so when can you capture it? When are you liable for it? But when we talk about like asteroid mining, which is, you know, especially for rare metals and that sort of thing, it seems like a viable way forward. You know, is there any clarity coming forward about, you know, how does a company actually, you know, either get permission or through, you know, in U.S. law, you have, you know, similar to squatter's rights, if you're on a piece of land for a short amount of time, you're a violator. But eventually, if you're there for long enough, you acquire the rights to it. How do you see that playing out in terms of the development of property rights for something like an asteroid or in outer space?
Oh, hi, Matt. How are you?
Wonderful.
Cool. They're really good questions. I think that property rights in space are one of the areas that where there's a lot of confusion if you're not in that particular field. The Outer Space Treaty sets out the principle of non-appropriation, I think in the second article, where no nation or anybody else can own property in space. So that's one of the most important fundamentals underlying everything else. But now we have these new national regulations that are coming out from the US and Luxembourg, which are granting companies, commercial operations who mine asteroids or materials on celestial bodies in space, the rights to the materials that they mine. And so there's a bit of discussion in the international community related to, well, if there's this principle of non-appropriation within the Outer Space Treaty that the majority of nations have agreed to, then is it legal actually to say that citizens have property rights over the materials? What do you think?
Yeah, you know, when they think about like long term, like, okay, say we're settling Mars. I can't imagine settling Mars without like a property right to own the space. Like if you can't like rent or lease or own your land, the development of a community around, at least in the United States and in many Anglo countries, like basic property rights create a flourishing of the economy because you're stable and like someone just can't, you know, someone comes on your piece of land, you can tell them, you know, it's not yours. So, you know, whether you do that through a licensing regime, through like international organization, I think it's very hard to see like a real flourishing in Mars or on the moon or wherever without some sort of baseline property rights for individuals or companies to own. So, yeah, I just see that like there's an inherent tension in sort of the way that things tend to develop on Earth, which are property based, and the way that they're set up to go forward in the future internationally. And it seems like as a company, you would just have to break that rule and take the property and just hope that your country isn't going to enforce it against you, which seems like the way that the United States is setting that up.
Well, it's interesting you say that. It's actually because my area is mining and space law, I have a lot to do with space mining and looking at these particular rights in space. And there's actually a group called the Hague Space Resource Governance Working Group. And what it's doing is it's looking at what a framework for managing mining activities in space might look like. And what they did is they put out a set of principles for people to look at. So it's the draft building blocks for the development of an international framework on space resource activities, and they've circulated this amongst a number of different organisations and people across the world who are involved in this area. And if anyone's interested in looking at the document, I can send it to Denise and you can all look at it later on. But it actually talks about how they're going to manage these particular sites where people are undertaking mining activities. And one of the interesting questions that they ask are, how are they going to ensure that access to space resources is fair for everybody that wants to mine them? Let's say we find something of particular value in one area. They're suggesting that they might assign priority rights to an operator who finds a particular resource for a particular amount of time. And I see this as something which is going to create a problem. You think about the gold rush, people rushing to mine gold. Isn't that just another way of creating a little bit more of a, exclusion? Because when you look at property rights, it's all about the right to exclude others. So if then they're going to attribute priority rights to an operator mining an asteroid, to me that almost seems like, okay, well, we know the Outer Space Treaty says we can't appropriate a celestial body or an asteroid, but maybe we can just give a priority right. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I can't imagine putting the investment into going out, building the rocket, and going and building searching for oil. Like, I'm sure that searching through for metals is similar, that you don't know if you're going to find the right metal. You don't have a firm cost analysis of whether you're going to find it. And I can't imagine going and doing that and then having the same rights as someone who didn't go find it first. I think that your investment in finding these sort of assets I don't think it would happen without some sort of priority right or property right to it.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And how do you make it fair for people who might have found the rights at the same time? How do you come to that decision about who gets priority if you get some people that arrive at the same time?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Hopefully there's just enough.
That's an interesting question.
Yeah, hopefully there's just enough asteroids that, different people can be mining different asteroids. But I mean, I don't know that much about space to say how many asteroids there are. But that seems there's just so much out there. And you think about it from, a resource perspective, what we consider rare earth metals are incredibly valuable, and they potentially at least are on asteroids. And you think about all your screens and all your phones; those have rare earth metals in them. And so right now, most of that is developed is resourced is comes from China. And so internationally, there may be like game theory going around in terms of we want, a country who has the rare earth metals right now wouldn't want those mined extraterritorially. So like, because the value of their earth metals would go down as a result. So there's interesting like game theories like economically that you kind of have to work out internationally in determining what's fair for mining in outer space.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that's really, you know, I think that one of the great things about everything, there are lots of great things that have come out of the Outer Space Treaty, and I know that it's a very old document and it is kind of out of step in some areas, and a lot of nations have made national legislation to fill in the gaps, as it were. But what it does do is the three core principles within the five space treaties about freedom of exploration, you know, peaceful operations, and making sure that, you know, this non-appropriation in the beginning happens. It's meant that we've had peaceful operations so far. If you discount all of the jamming and all of that kind of stuff that happens, we've never had a major warlike incident in space in 51 years, and that's an achievement.
Yeah, that's great. There's no question about that. Well, I'm sorry that I have to jump up now, and I look forward to listening to the rest of this. I think that your expertise is exceptional, and I like how you outlined your story of step by step getting there. So thanks for coming on, and sorry I have to leave early.
Matt, it's been so
no
great
worries.
Having
I'll
you.
Catch you again.
Yeah, thanks, Denise.
And thank you for joining us, Matt, and thank you for teeing up my next question so beautifully. Do listen to the rest of the show, okay?
I will, and I got to see the animal selfie later.
Yes, you do.
Okay.
All right. So what I'm referring to in the discussion that we just had and the questions and the context that Kim and Matt have been discussing, we've been talking about how do you determine priorities if there's a tie to who discovered a particular resource. We've been talking in terms of real property. We've been talking in terms of ownership rights and expansion. And I've been sitting here thinking that if there are advanced intelligences not of Earth origin that are having these same discussions in the same kinds of terms in their own language, I'm terrified, right? Should they ever stumble upon us, right? So my question for you, Kim, is whether the Outer Space Treaty or the Hague Group that you mentioned, or anyone in any sort of official policymaking capacity, has ever addressed that issue. And I'll PS that with the fact that one of our stalwarts in chat, one of our audience members who joins us frequently, CRL in chat, I asked people to ask us their questions. I ran down what I planned to cover, and I've been getting a few other suggestions of things. And one of the things CRL said was, I think the news just broke either yesterday or today that NASA has announced there are organic compounds on Mars that they didn't know were there. And so he asked if the newly discovered organic compounds on Mars have agency. And I think it's the same kind of question. You know, we have sort of a template as humanity for how expansion has happened here on Earth over the various centuries. And a lot of those stories were very violent and turbulent and not great for those expanded upon. And I'm wondering, Kim, what we are doing in a forward-looking, space-looking way to avoid some of those mistakes of our past.
So I don't know. This is not really my area of expertise. But what I can tell you is that I know that in terms of missions that go out into space. There's a lot of focus on not contaminating the environment with our own materials when we take a spacecraft, say, to Mars or, you know, into orbit or all of that type of thing. So I don't know if you remember the mission that was orbiting Saturn, and I can't recall the name of that one. Can you remember which one? It was only, I think it was this year or the end of last year.
The one that crashed into Saturn?
Yes.
That was Cassini.
Yeah, so Cassini, that one, I'm not sure if you were aware, but they crashed it into Saturn so that there would be no contamination. So rather than keeping it orbiting, it was burnt up in the atmosphere so that there would be no future contamination.
I did not know that. That's good to know.
I'm pretty sure that's correct, but I'm sure someone will correct me if I'm wrong. And because that always happens, which
yes.
is great. I love to actually get the facts. And so I know that in terms of national security, people talk about national security and the infrastructure that is in space for every nation. There are satellites that are critical to different parts of national security. And so I'm sure that, you know, there are a lot of actual programs that look out for asteroids that are orbiting through the solar system. I'm sure that they're not just looking for asteroids and celestial bodies and comets and things like that. It makes sense that there would be programs which actually have the purpose of making sure that we know if there's an incoming Death Star.
Okay, I think that we'll move away from, now that we sort of know that there are treaties and principles, but they're not going to really deal with any of our specific upcoming conundrum very well. We'll move into some of those specific activities. I just wanted to check with Stefan. Stefan, anything you want to ask or comment upon before we move on?
Sure. You know, what I found striking about the last discussion involving property rights was you know, the assumption that we can take what we have here on Earth and sort of map it onto space. And I think in one of the articles I was looking through before coming on today, there was sort of this analogy of, you know, is space more like the oceans or is it more like Antarctica? In that, you know, everybody can kind of sail around on the ocean, but you know, you have limited fishing rights, so you can't appropriate endlessly from the ocean. Or is it more like Antarctica, which is a little bit more heavily regulated and not everybody can necessarily get there? And so I was wondering if you had a perspective on that, with, first of all, whether it makes sense to think of space as just an extension of the Earth where sort of the legal regimes we have here are going to be appropriate for space. And if it is appropriate, do you see it as more like the oceans or more like Antarctica?
So hi, Stefan. Are you thinking more about in the future when people are actually or might colonize space? So we're
yes.
thinking hundreds of years in the future. Is that kind of where you're going with that?
Yeah, I think not necessarily hundreds of years, but as we do those initial forays into space, you know, let's say a company puts a rocket into orbit, lands on an asteroid, and starts trying to appropriate materials. Our earlier discussion seemed premised on the idea that you can just take the legal concepts that arose on Earth and extend them into space. And my question is, does that make sense to you conceptually? Is that the right way to think about it, or should we be thinking about entirely new structures and institutions to govern space?
So this is how I think about law and space and how it all fits together. When you think about the human race and law, that as we know, you know, law has been around for there's evidence it's been around for thousands of years. And when you look at every major technological development in human history, so for example, when you look at ships that sail the seas, ocean law developed, when you look at balloons and aeroplanes being developed, we extended law to cover the sky. When we started sending rockets into space, we extended the legal system to cover what happened into space. And I think that every single different legal system, when you look at, so you mentioned the Antarctic Treaty and you mentioned the oceans, the law governing oceans, and I think every single one of those different types of laws, and if you look at aviation law as well, they're all different and they all fit the circumstance or the technology that they're meant to cover. Does that make sense?
It does, and I think what's striking about the analogy to me about oceans is that people have been sailing the oceans since long before we had any kind of codified legal system that we can recognize today. And you can't say the same thing about space. And it's going to be, for the first while, presumably, once we start getting more routine travel into space, it's going to be a handful of very rich nations that can do that. And it's a much less democratic process than putting a boat in the water and then trying to figure out how do we govern this structure. And I'm wondering, are we limiting ourselves too much if we think about space as an extension of the Earth and try to take the concepts that we've developed here and apply to it? And should we be thinking more in sort of these categorical shifts of, you know, rather than trying to piecemeal expand, you know, is it an opportunity to think about, you know, supranational institutions in a new, more robust way? And I guess that... you know, I'm thinking out loud here, but that's what strikes me is that it really isn't a lot like the ocean. It's quite different. And is it different in a way that's legally significant? And to me, it intuitively seems like it probably is.
Yeah, I think that you make a really good point there about talking about, you know, the nations who are expanding into space are the rich nations, and it's not a democrat, it's not as easy as putting a ship into the ocean, and nor can countries who don't have the financial resources to reach into space. You're going to find that the law has always followed, you know, I guess, I hate to say it, that the law follows the money in a way. You know, you have these rich nations able to take these steps. And so the idea that you can develop something new and different, which is not just an extension of what is occurring here on Earth, what do you see as the way that you could reach that nirvana in a way, I guess? Because if you've got these rich nations leading the development out into space, what's the impetus for making this different kind of a system?
So from my perspective, what's striking is that the treaty, the treaty that was drafted 51 years ago is quite idealistic. It seems to me quite short. I think it's like 17 sort of broad items in there. And I'm speculating here, but I wonder when they drafted it, were they really contemplating the kind of commercial exploitation that we're now talking about? Or was it drafted with the same level of details you might draft a treaty now about like surfing a black hole? You know, like we could talk speculatively about going into a black hole at this point, but we have no way of understanding what that would look like. And so whatever we put down on paper is essentially meaningless. And so in 1967, were they thinking in those terms like, okay, well, we can put anything down we want because this isn't going to happen in our lifetime? Or were they being thoughtful? And if they weren't being thoughtful, then why should we limit ourselves to the principles they laid out, first of all? And second of all, I think if you accept the reality that the space race is going to be defined by the wealthy and the powerful, is that something you can live with? I mean, and if we can't live with it, we have a narrow and closing window of time when we can say, you know, we don't want the law to evolve in this way. We want to actually be thoughtful and lay out principles that truly are fair and try to do it that way. If you don't do it, then I agree, you're stuck with, you know, the rich get to define the terms of engagement and everybody else is going to follow suit. And maybe that's fine. I don't mean to take a position on that. It's interesting. We're trying to sort of shoehorn the current laws into this treaty that was, drafted in 1967 without really a great sense of were they being thoughtful, or was that just kind of a pie in the sky treaty at the time? So that kind of stood out to me as interesting.
So I think that, you know, the treaty was drafted obviously without knowing that we were going to be making these great, you know, discoveries in the 50 years following. And you can even see it in the text of the treaty, where they didn't even contemplate commercial companies being a part, because when you look at the language of the treaty, it's really about state parties and what state party responsibilities are. And a lot of the other international framework mechanisms, like multilateral agreements and the steps that are being taken at the United Nations Committee on Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, they have a legal subcommittee which is looking at exactly the question of, you know, the rich nations are leading this movement into outer space, and how can we make sure that everyone has a voice? And so at that committee, the UN COPUS, that's an opportunity for every nation to step in and put their perspective up on the table. So it's really interesting reading those documents, because you can see that there are a number of nations who are making forward movement in areas like asteroid mining, and promulgating domestic regulations like the new bill that we mentioned earlier, that other nations are saying, well, hang on a second, I'm not sure that you can really say that, for example, your citizens, like citizens of the US, under domestic legislation, have property rights over the materials that they mine in an asteroid. So there's a very real discussion happening at that international level right now that seeks, I think, to change the conversation. So does that answer does that kind of fill in some of the gaps?
I think it does for me, yes. Thank you.
Yeah, cool.
I had sort of an observation and a follow-up question from the discussion we're having, and that is that you've properly and accurately pointed out, Stefan, that we're dealing with a 51-year-old document that probably didn't try to, or nor could have, anticipated the situations that are going to unfold specifically. But that same description could be, except much older documents, could be applied to various nations' constitutions and other things that we hold dear and try and adhere to far, far down the road. So I'm wondering, Kim, you know, what sort of force people accord these early efforts at governing our conduct in space? Will they just be thrown out when they're viewed as archaic, or will we have, you know, a space exploration Supreme Court attempting to close read them and interpret them?
Oh, wow. that's mind-boggling, thinking there would be a court looking at all this stuff. I think that when you look at that, the treaty, which is very lofty in its ideals, you know, peaceful uses, freedom of exploration, non-appropriation, whilst it might be vague, that does give us the opportunity to fill in the gaps with domestic legislation that helps countries to further their own national goals. And so the mechanisms that currently exist in tandem with the space treaty, like there are guidelines for reduction of space debris. So, you know, when you have a launch, when you launch a rocket, there is a certain amount of debris from explosive bolts and flakes of paint and bits and pieces that happen when you do a launch, and all of that stuff sits in orbit. I'm not sure if you've seen some of the data to do with space debris, which is in orbit currently, but it's a big problem and it's only getting bigger. There's a voluntary guideline, which is for space debris mitigation, that countries are able to use to help reduce that particular amount of debris. And I know that the US has, within the domestic legislation, and don't ask me to pinpoint it because I can't, I can look it up, but I know that there are explosive debris limits for NASA launches, for commercial launches, and different countries have been integrating those particular guidelines within their domestic legislation. But those sorts of voluntary guidelines are kind of are doing the work to fill the gap between a 51-year-old document that had no concept, like Stefan mentioned, of, you know, a treaty to do with black holes or legislation to do with that. We couldn't contemplate what there would be to do with that area. But there are these other guidelines that can help people to navigate between, you know, because if you remember, the international treaty is just a framework. It's really just a guideline. And so when you start to look at the future, it worries me about, you know, how many other bits of documentation am I going to have to know about to be across all of this, to be honest,
right?
You know, as we move forwards. But it seems like, you know, you have all of this agreement to the treaty. Changing a treaty is hard, and once you once nations act in a particular way, then you have actual practice that happens, which is regarded as, you know, what you do. And so how do you get from that? That's a question. How do you get from having this type of treaty to further towards what Stefan might have mentioned about, you know, having a system which is not just an expansion of what we have on the earth?
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating thing to ponder, and obviously not something that we're going to be able to answer today, but I'm glad we've thought about it. Let's move on and think about specific activities. One of the things we already mentioned was the Moon Treaty, and something I want to specifically discuss is colonization. Our Commerce Secretary here in the United States, Wilbur Ross, published an op-ed at the end of May titled "That Moon Colony Will Be a Reality Sooner Than You Think." He is definitely thinking about space exploration in his job as Secretary of Commerce. And he concludes his piece by saying, "This is a very special time in space history. There is a convergence of technology, capital, and political will. The United States must seize this moment." So he very much wants us to be out there claiming and colonizing and doing whatever else makes commerce sense for the United States. So let's talk about the Moon and Mars and the laws that will govern Wilbur Ross being able to establish the first moon colony, for example, Kim.
Yeah, I guess there's nothing to say, can't.
So anybody who wants to go put up structures on the moon can go do it as long as they've got the tech. There's really nothing that says can't do that or I've got to get buy-in from someone else.
Well, I know the Moon Treaty talks about, you know, you're meant to do things on the moon for research. You know, it's free and open for research. But, you know, that legal principle of if something is not specifically prohibited, then it's permitted. You know, what do you think, Stefan?
Well, I think that they should follow the rules of like San Francisco neighborhoods and impose really strict aesthetic requirements on what you build on the moon, because God forbid we have a 13-story brutalist structure on there, as the first building. So I think that'll just depress everybody. I hope it's clear I'm being quite facetious.
I think Samsung's going to put an ice rink there that's visible from here, from Earth.
Right. Right, and then you're going to upset all the Canadians by expanding into the hot regions of the moon and getting them to have expansion teams before bringing it back to Quebec. So.
Correct.
That might be a really good point, though, Stefan, because I know that at the NASA Kennedy Space Center, they've been working on turning moon regolith into a kind of a concrete that you can 3D print to make structures. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's going to be one ugly-looking building.
I don't know. So, I think we're making strides in that area. That we're very much in the preliminary era of 3D printed buildings, but I don't think that ultimately they're going to be as bad as you think, Kim.
Well, I'm not sure. I've seen some of this regolith turned into stuff. It's not good looking.
I've seen some that exist today that I would actually happily go spend time in. So it can only improve.
Awesome. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I suppose the same thing goes for Mars. Harder to get to, more at stake, but if you're going to undertake it, have at it.
Yeah, I know there's like that program, what is it, Mars 100, that we're looking at, asking people to put up their hand if they wanted to go on a one-way trip to Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure where they are in their development to do with that, but I'd worry about someone who'd be willing to say, yeah, I'll go to Mars and I'll stay there. What do you think?
I worry about drafting the ironclad liability waiver that commits someone's consent to being on a one-way trip in a legally valid and binding way. I also wonder if, in fact, people are able to get to the moon and Mars and decide that this is going to be their home for a while or forever.
Yeah.
We touched on this a little, the notion that we're just going to import the laws of the Earth to these outer space environments, how we're going to govern communities that are established off Earth. And I wonder if you know, Kim, of any discussions or ideas or governing documents that purport to be able to address that.
Oh, about moving the legal system off of the Earth. No, I haven't come across anything specifically to do with that. I've read a lot of, like you say, op-ed pieces about, what it might look like. I think I've read a couple of science fiction stories that Stanley Robinson has got, like, a series of three books, Red Mars, Blue Mars and Green Mars, something like that. And it actually talks about, they send a number of people to Mars to establish a colony. And what happens after a period of time is that colony becomes independent from the Earth and they set up their own legal system, which looks surprisingly like, the legal system on Earth. It's just different in terms of what their obligations are within the colony. So, but I haven't actually seen anything else, not any particular documentation to do with that.
Yeah. Well, this is just my own speculation and intuition and has no basis in law, reality, or research. But my own speculation and intuition would be that the way that we've handled things on the ISS, where there are different nationality regions, right? And the law of one place applies in one part of the ISS and the law of another place applies in the other. I feel like that would go out the window once you're on another body as opposed to being in orbit around the Earth. Do you feel that way too?
I think that, you know, if you were to be on Mars, it's a really, really long way from the Earth. Mm-hmm. So I guess, you know, I don't know about you, but I might start to feel like, well, hey, they're really long way away. Whose army's going to make me do it?
Right. Yeah, good point. What do you think, Stefan?
Yeah, it's funny because on one hand, this is a very future-focused discussion because what we're talking about is something that is still completely hypothetical and we can't even kind of imagine the steps of getting from where we are today to get to the point where we actually have a colony on the Mars. On the other hand, what we're talking about is really looking in the past because it's almost an opportunity for us to think about how would we have designed our system differently knowing what we know now about its faults. To make it work better, and it's an opportunity to really rethink fundamental principles in our legal system and whether or not it's fair. My intuition is that nobody's going to be too concerned about fairness at the point that we actually go from not being on the on Mars to being on Mars, and that's a concern because I think I think it's hopeful to think about fairness and about distributing resources in a way that's equitable. I have seen no evidence in human nature to suggest that that's going to be anybody's priority. And I think as odd as this might sound, I would encourage people to go and read Leviathan. You know, Thomas Hobbes is probably as good an authority on what's going to happen when we get to Mars as any kind of science fiction writer might be. And so hope springs eternal, but at the same time, nothing I have ever seen or read suggests to me that we're going to be, thinking about this primarily as an opportunity to be as equitable as we can. I think to the contrary, it's going to be a mad race to dominance and then sort of ex post facto justification for any rules that we articulate in the course of achieving that dominance. And so that's my that's my happy thought on this Friday.
Yeah, that is a happy thought.
Yeah.
One of the pieces in our rundown for today is about colonization and talking about something that Kim touched on before, this notion that in the Outer Space Treaty that's 51 years old is this concept that we're going to try and not have our biosphere collide with and contaminate another biosphere. So though there are plans to colonize Mars and people who have signed up. And as I understand it, they keep pushing out the date when this is going to become a reality, understandably so. One of our pieces talks about the first Mars astronauts, the first people going to Mars actually staying in orbit and not touching down because of that concern that we're not going to be sterile for that environment. And as you know, just in the last 48 hours, I think NASA is now saying there are, if not, you know, actually functioning organic organisms, then at least organic building blocks there so that it actually functions as a biosphere. So I guess I want to explore the tension between this document that doesn't really have full legal force, but seems to have a lot of respect, and say the Secretary of Commerce of the United States discussing a convergence of technology, capital, and political will to get the heck out there and do our thing. What do you think, Kim?
I think that, you know, when a nation decides that they're going to go forwards and make a point, I guess, you know, because that's kind of what it seems to me to be. Like, we want to be first on the moon to colonize the moon. I noted that the policy, what was it called, SPD2 or something that Donald Trump just signed, which was a policy directive to the US government that will complete a number of actions that will, in theory, make it easier for US companies and entrepreneurs to access space. One of the things that he said was that this time when we go to the moon, we're not just going to plant a flag and leave footprints, we're going to stay there. You know, that's what leads me to be thinking it's about making a point. It's about being the first, you know. What do you guys all think about that? Do you think I'm on point or, you know?
I think that it's a combination of things, that there probably is, you know, some sort of national pride bound up in the desire to get there, be first. But it's economic too, right? It's this exploitation and property rights issue that we started the discussion with. That there's so much to be gained, I guess, from being early on in the land grab. And so I think it's probably a combination of those two things. Yeah, for those who are wondering or haven't heard what Kim is referring to, on May 24th, President Trump signed something called the SPD2, the Space Policy Directive, the goals of which is to have the Department of Commerce be a one-stop shop for companies wishing to go to space, explore in space, mine in space, colonize in space, to get whatever regulatory approvals they need from the U.S. government, at any rate, to conduct business. So that is a recent player on the legal scene and how this is going to work. One sort of funny question I've had in the back of my mind as we've had this discussion is, you know, okay, we're trying to incentivize space development, space exploration, private enterprise in space. So if you're just some renegade cowboy or cowgirl with a lot of money and the ability to hire people that can do reckless things, what sort of regulations do we have here on Earth that prevent someone from just, you know, finding a vacant lot and deciding it's a launch pad, that kind of thing? I mean, are we confined to just our local zoning restrictions on that kind of activity, or do you know, on a national level, do nations frown upon this?
Oh, so you're talking about the specific authorizations to conduct any kind of launch activity? So
yes,
they do exist.
That kind of thing. Yes.
Yeah, so they do exist. They're each, so let me start from the very beginning. So the Outer Space Treaty, in one of its articles, it's Article 6, says that nation states, so countries, have to bear international responsibility for activities in outer space. Article 7 says that when they do those activities, any damage that's caused will be, they'll be financially responsible for that damage. And so every nation has domestic legislation. So nations who conduct activities in outer space have national legislation which authorises launches and re-entries, and those national legislations differ depending on what those nations actually do. So does that make sense? So yes, it is frowned upon to just launch something. If you do it, there are criminal penalties for that type of thing in most domestic legislation.
Great. So the frothy enthusiasm that seems to be out there has some boundaries and limits and reasonable governance around it. That's good. All right, let's talk about mining, because that's one of the things that people want to go out and do. If you're not on Mars or the moon, the next, I guess, most likely place for you to be if you've left Earth orbit, is an asteroid trying to extract its potentially trillions of dollars worth of resources. And that's what got you interested in this whole thing to begin with, right, Kim?
Yeah, I mean, because I worked as a research scientist in mining, it seemed like a natural extension for me to move towards this area. And because there's been so much interest in this area, and because it's starting to move forwards, and you see evidence of the change in the fact that the US and Luxembourg have set up domestic legislation specifically to do with space resource utilisation. That's really what got me interested. You know, that question of how do you manage technology in space and mining that and mining material? How do you manage all of that activity? Because as you know, on Earth, terrestrial mining is managed by every domestic framework, you know, and there's a regime for exploration, you know, licenses for mining, all of those sorts of legislative frameworks that give guidelines for environmental governance as well as just the actual physical regulation of taking materials out of the ground or out of an asteroid, if it were. So it's, you know, there are so many crossover areas. That's why I became so interested in this.
Yeah. I keep coming back to the notion that I think we need some sort of space EPA and some sort of some sort of determination. You know, I think we've talked about people at least taking a beat, possibly having astronauts stay in orbit before they plunge down to Mars and establish colonies and begin terraforming in even small ways. But asteroids seem to be the second-class citizens in that kind of scenario. You know, if they don't have an atmosphere, I get the feeling there's not going to be a whole lot of examination and analysis of what the asteroid consists of unless it's, you know, full of some precious mineral that needs to be taken out. Whatever else is there is probably going to fall prey to the commercial interests that we're anxious to send out there. And I just, I don't, you know, is that, I don't know if I feel great about that, but I feel like it's kind of inevitable. Do you agree?
It's an interesting question because if you look at what's happened on orbit in terms of the space debris that's been created so far from the activities that have been undertaken. So, because you think about, we have active and inactive satellites on orbit. We have debris from launches, which include those explosive bolts, like I was talking about, flakes of paint, bits of stuff that might have fallen off of spacecraft. So you go through and you look at all of that material in space, and on top of all of those operational bits of material, there is debris from a number of directed satellite destruction activities. So two countries decided to, and I won't say which ones they are, you can find it out really easily, two countries decided to destroy their own satellites. And what happened is they turned one satellite into 5,000 or 10,000 pieces, effectively, and that material is orbiting the Earth currently. So what's happening is that as we start conducting more and more space activities, that debris is going to grow, and that's one of the reasons why that the space debris mitigation guidelines, the voluntary guidelines, were brought into being. That's one of the reasons how they came about. And so at an international level, because that debris is going to hinder operations going forwards. There was a mitigation guideline that was brought into play. But I'm with you in the question in that I wonder also if there's no negative consequence from, let's say, mining an asteroid for a precious material and all the other material on the asteroid is destroyed in some way. What's going to be the catalyst in stopping that environmental degradation or any kind of pollution or problem that it causes? With you, and I wonder the same thing. If there's not actually a negative consequence to the pollution, even though the Outer Space Treaty, and I think it's Article 9, says you're supposed to avoid harmful contamination when you conduct space activities.
Right.
You know, what is it that's going to make people control the pollution or destruction of environments? And you're absolutely right. How is that going to work?
And not to get too existential and philosophical here, but these are pretty existential and philosophical issues that we're pondering. there are at least some who speculate with good evidence and scientific rigor that the reason that life exists here is because an asteroid or a series of asteroids hit us and deposited, I don't know, name your necessary thing for life, organic molecules, water, etc. And if, you know, obviously there are lots of them out there, but if we deflect the one that would have hit another planet and did the same thing so that we could extract its uranium or whatever is there, I don't feel great about that.
Oh,
or maybe I do. Maybe that planet would have come here and treated us as real estate. So I don't know.
You really have just blown my, like, if you could see me on video now, you would have seen my head just blew up.
I know.
That's a great question. I love it.
Stefan, anything you want to ask about mining or colonization before we hit some of the other topics in our rundown here?
I'll just quickly observe that it's interesting hearing this discussion because it assumes that the decision makers at this juncture are going to be sort of individuals who are operating with the same moral and ethical frameworks as we currently have now. I think it's reasonable to assume by the time we're facing this problem, ethical decision making and moral decision making of the type that impacts policies in a legal system will not be made by an individual, human being. It'll probably be processed through some very sophisticated AI, and I wonder what that will look like. Will we have really efficient moral units by the time we're making these decisions so that we can precisely calculate the costs of mining an asteroid and polluting? I mean, we won't be limited to the judgment of the handful of people who've gotten themselves into positions of authority in a given system. Maybe we'll have a more comprehensive algorithm-driven determinant of what is and is not the right course of action. And I think as long as we're imagining these scenarios of, mining asteroids and colonizing Mars, we should, and we're thinking about the technology that is going to enable that, we should also acknowledge that there's going to be a shift in our ethical framework and the inputs that impact that ethical framework. And I think AI is going to be correspondingly developing with sort of rocket technology and may, for better or for worse, impact the way that we weigh the moral consequences of our actions. And so very difficult for me to imagine that we're going to ever face a situation and have to resolve it with the moral frameworks that we developed sort of as we were, as Britain was sort of dealing with private property disputes in the 16 and 1700s. I think we'll have an entirely new framework, or at least one that is optimized with AI. And so that's my little bit of speculation to make this even more existential for you.
Right. It's a totally valid and right on point and further blows, I think, all of our heads thinking about what that means.
Absolutely.
I'm trying to cobble together. We put these MCLE passphrases into the show every week in case someone is watching or listening to obtain continuing legal education credit if they are a lawyer, or professional credit in other fields by watching or listening to the show. And we put these phrases in so that they can demonstrate that they've actually watched or listened. So they go in randomly. I cobbled them together on the fly. Let's make space junk the first one. And then I'll do another one later in the show. And that's a good segue, actually, into the next topic I wanted to hit, which sort of relates to something you were mentioning a moment ago, Kim, about space junk and the fact that, you know, as more activity happens, the problem's going to get worse and not better. And one of the things that's been floated around, one of the concepts by the president of the United States and others, is to establish a space force, perhaps, some sort of equivalent to a quasi-military or military force that would police activities in space and make sure that, you know, as we have more and more private players up there, that everyone is behaving according to whatever legal concepts we decide apply to them. So whether it's the Space Force, or there's a piece in our rundown for today, and I've been meaning to mention, there's so much good reading that we have done to prepare for the show today. If you want to do any of that reading yourself, if you go to tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw, we are on episode 425 this week. Everything we're referring to, looking at, talking about is there for you, and you can read all these sources. And I will put in the information about the Hague panel or working group that Kim mentioned, yes, as well, when she sends that to me. So there's a piece from an organization called Space News that's arguing for a space guard modeled on the U.S. Coast Guard as opposed to a space force. But this whole concept that we need cops in space, what do you think about that, Kim?
I'm one of those lawyers that I think we already have too many laws. I don't like more laws, and I don't like more levels of governance, because I always like to believe that people can do the right thing. Now, that's a really naive viewpoint. I know that, but I still would prefer that people self-regulate, because you think about it, I mean, what's the critical mass of operations on orbit that have to happen for there to be a space force or whatever in place? What would they do, and how are they going to deter behaviour that's not optimal, I guess? And So I think that I can imagine that in the future, you know, if there's so much activity in space, and if people are not doing the right thing, then there will need to be some kind of, you know, authority. But I'm not sure that it's going to look like Well, I am sure that it's not going to look like what we currently have. What do you guys think?
Whew, that's a hard concept to get one's head around. I guess I start from the notion that, you know, superpower governments are thinking about some sort of force, people who would be trained and charged with various duties, and what that would look like, and certainly there are things that you would want to curtail and make sure that we're not doing damage to ourselves or potentially to space tardigrades, as we've been discussing in IRC. But yes, I guess I feel like something like that is going to evolve, and I hope we evolve it wisely and cooperatively among the nations of the world, and that, you know, we don't have the equivalent of the Russian Space Navy and the U.S. Space Navy duking it out for, you know, what's going to be permitted and what's not, and what's going to be policed and what's not. I don't know. It's kind of a scary concept, but I think it's kind of a scary concept not to have some sort of oversight as we're wild westing and encouraging private enterprise to wild west out into Earth orbit and beyond. What do you think, Stefan?
Well, I think, again, this is another one of those situations where you've got, you know, we're imagining space as though we can access it without modifying our bodies or without relying on technology and without going through a very narrow set of gatekeepers. And I think at the end of the day, the people who are going to be getting out there are going to be going through what's essentially a technological interface. And I don't trust that the people monitoring that interface are going to allow free access. I mean, you can't even, you know, download a song without accepting hundreds of pages of terms of use. And you can imagine a situation where in order to live in space in these colonies, you're going to have to interface with a very, very complex set of technological features, each of which will have its own terms of use. And, you know, what happens if you violate that term of use? Can someone shut down your access to the thing you need to live? Will that be made subject to criminal law? I mean, you can really get down a rabbit hole here. But at the end of the day, because we're not talking about an atmosphere that you can live on organically as a human being, you're going to be reliant on property rights and technologies. And then the owners of those technologies will presumably have some stake in controlling access to them. And so you'll essentially be living in an intellectual property problem. and your ability to continue to exist will be dependent on how those ownership rights are distributed. And so this is what I'm talking about when I say that we need to imagine this as a very different set of conditions as we have on Earth, because I think it is actually structurally and ethically and foundationally different from what we have here. And if you think it's onerous to accept read and accept a term of use when it's impacting your ability to listen to a song, imagine what you'll feel like if it's impacting your ability to breathe. And I think we may not need cops, because maybe when you violate, you go outside the scope of what you're permitted to use, you'll simply be denied access. And upon denial of access, you will literally perish. And so,
that sounds like the great script for a science fiction novel. I'm going to get that down right now.
You know, it's funny. I think somebody mentioned we're all space nerds, and actually, I think I have to be the only IP attorney who like actively dislikes sci-fi for the most part.
You're a rare breed.
Rare breed. Except, you know, there's anyway.
Wow, but no, you make a very excellent point, and we've already touched on the fact that, you know, I'm sure that whatever this document, I think it would be interesting to look at whatever documentation people are signing. I wonder if they're even making it public as they're signing up for the Mars colony in progress. What exactly are they signing up for, and what exactly are they giving away aside from any sort of expectation or right to demand a ride home? The legal framework just of that experiment has got to be fascinating. And I love your concept of living inside an IP problem.
Earth, and then the law is imposed on you because you sort of life itself is pre-law in a sense that there's nothing inherent about life that requires law on Earth. But if you're reliant entirely on technology to live on an asteroid or on Mars, and you port over the IP system or the property system that we have on Earth, then you are entirely reliant on the legal system in a sense in order to live. And I think that's a reversal of the conditions on Earth. And in that sense, it kind of turns all of our assumptions about the normative structures of law and how individuals relate to the legal system that governs them on its head. And I think that's actually sort of what's animating my pushback on this idea that we can simply grow the conditions that we have on Earth into space. I think we're actually inverting them in an interesting way.
Yeah, and I think the follow-on to that, too, there was an interesting series. I forget who produced it. It might have been National Geographic's network on TV. It was called Mars, and it was speculating what the first several years or maybe decades of a Mars colony would look like, and it sort of grappled with these practical issues that they might face aside from just bare survival, right? And one of the things that came through in that, or that the writers foresaw, is that not only would you be living inside an intellectual property problem because of what was governing you, what you had agreed to, but you, I think how they portrayed it is the individuals there were sort of, had become the intellectual property of whoever had sent them there. That, you know, they would have to do various marketing communications, and, you know, that they had some sort of responsibility as part of this enterprise. They were almost, I don't know if they were sort of employees and were in the parameters of what you'd have to do to be a responsible employee. But of course, your job extends to your whole life at that point, if what you are is part of that adventure. So I think that's an interesting thing to think about too. Kim, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, the whole paradigm of what we've been used to in terms of the legal framework of living our lives, if you're then going to take that life and live in space or conduct activities in space, say as a tourist, then that's bound to change. And I know you touched on it earlier about, you know, what would the liability waiver look like if you're going on a one-way trip to Mars. You know, even the liability waivers for those first people who are on trips into space, those waivers sign away rights for recourse and stops people from assigning, stops relatives from accessing rights as well. So it's a whole different sort of paradigm that we're starting to move into. I think Stefan's right there in terms of what we think now and trying to extend that framework to what's going to happen in the future. It's not going to be the same. There's going to have to be a different way of looking at it.
All right, we could obviously talk about this for a very long time. There's so much fun to discuss. We have about 15 minutes left, and there are some things I want to hit. One thing before we leave the discussion we're having right now is just to, I think that the expectations of someone who's signing on to be a colonist or a miner are going, and the responsibilities of that person are going to look very different than the expectations and responsibilities of someone who's paying a ton of money to sign up to be a space tourist, right? I mean, they are, or maybe not, you know? I mean, I think that read the fine print, people, is all I can say if you're going to space. Kim, are we going to be hit by the Chinese space station, and who do I sue?
Oh, it already crashed into the ocean, so I think over Easter, so we're all good, and your government will take care of it if it crashes into your country, so that you can seek recourse through political channels if there's some kind of a crash. And that's outlined, again, back to that treaty. There's the Liability Convention of 1972, which is one of the, so the Outer Space Treaty is one of the treaties, and then there's five treaties in total, including that one. One of them's the 1972 Liability Convention, and that outlines what to do if the space station crashes into you.
Okay, phew. I'm glad we have that handled. One thing I didn't know until I started getting ready for this show is that at least the U.S. government plans to stop contributing federal funds to the International Space Station by 2025. What does that mean for the ISS, and are other companies following suit? What's happening to the ISS, Kim?
Well, as I understand it, the ISS is a collaboration between a number of countries, and I also understand that there's a certain lifespan of the station. So I can't remember what the end date was in the previous report, but the space station won't last forever because of things like biological build-up on the components inside the station. The station loses altitude all the time and has to be boosted up, and that takes fuel and obviously costs money. Sending people backwards and forwards to the station is another big cost as well. So I know that I've seen a couple of articles and things about there being commercial companies taking over the space station, but I'm not sure I've seen anything solid as yet in terms of what is happening. I was under the impression it was still in discussion.
Okay, good to know. Keep an eye on the ISS and what happens when and if it becomes privatized. And then the final thing I wanted to ask you, Kim, before we get into the concluding material for our show here, is but far and away the most common question that I got in the wake of the launch of the Falcon Heavy carrying the Tesla Roadster and Starman going into far Earth orbit is, how the heck do I get that Tesla back? What is the legal status of the Tesla? And there was a really funny crack by Boeing CEO Dennis, Muhlenberg, maybe? He was asked what he thought about whether Boeing was going to start launching cars into space. He said, "We might pick up the one out there and bring it back." So, you know, what do you think of that plan? Any legal barriers?
Well, technically, material that's launched into space remains the property of the person or company that launched it there. So without the permission of the owner of that property, technically, it's, you know, theft, I guess.
All right, and so if you're setting your reminders or a calendar event for this, it's supposed to come back close to Earth in 2091. So mark your calendar.
Yeah, I saw that. I was like, woohoo! The law might have changed by then.
That's right. We're going to put our second MCLE passphrase into the show, courtesy of IRC and our discussion about a space force or space guard. It's going to be, of course, drum roll, please, pigs in space is our second MCLE passphrase for the show. Oh, yeah. If you are a lawyer in the United States and you are interested in requesting MCLE credit for your enjoyment of our show, we do have a chart that is up at wiki.twit.tv. Find our This Week in Law page there. And the various U.S. jurisdictions are laid out with the various documentation that we know of as to how you might go about making that request. There are some regions of the U.S. that I wouldn't even try, but if you want to take a flyer on it, there's some resources there for you. Any thoughts, Stefan, before we move on? Any final observations about our discussion today?
I might have to stop telling people that I don't like sci-fi, because maybe I do. Maybe I just haven't read the right sci-fi, because it's surprisingly interesting.
Oh, yes. I would definitely say, I'm putting together a reading list for you in my brain as we speak. Everyone email Stefan with your favorite sci-fi. Too bad. I think Mike is going to be back next week, but if he's not and you want to join us, we have a sci-fi author friend of mine who's going to join us next week to discuss DNA reproductive technologies and the near future of those things. He's written a novel about that called Biohack. His name is J.D. Lassica. We're really looking forward to that show too. And that, I definitely put that one on your reading list. All right. So we're going to wrap up the show here. As we frequently do, we have some resources and a tip for you. But hard on the heels of our excellent space law discussion today, we bring you our animal selfie of the week. I will tee it up by saying that originally I started hunting around for an animal selfie that was along the lines of something Kim just mentioned, the fact that there is a lot of microbial non-human life aboard the space station that we didn't plan to bring there. And some of that has been photographed and videoed and studied, et cetera. But then in a more warm and fuzzy way, I discovered that we have done experiments on mice in zero gravity environments on the space station. And that is going to be our animal selfie of the week. Can we roll that video, please? Oh, and our bumper. Sorry, forgot about that. Okay, so we have video of this is a... one of our, so we have cut right to the 30-second mark in the video. The beginning of the video shows a mouse running around. And I believe what we're seeing here is the mouse actually floating in zero G. Yep, that mouse is floating. It's somersaulting around in zero G. And it is being captured by what I would call a trap camera or an automatic camera. The mouse is obviously not taking its own selfie, but there is no human photographer here that I can discern. This seems to be a camera that is trained on the research subject mouse, which I hope that at some point they held up to the window so it could enjoy the stunning, spectacular, mind-expanding view back at its home planet for having gone up there and floated around in space. So I'm glad to share with you all that mice have gone weightless. I'm guessing that many didn't know that. I didn't. Our tip of the week also has a space sort of overlay to it. And it's specifically for folks in California, and I imagine other states might have their own approach. But California was hoping or trying, at least some of the California legislators were trying to pass a law that would have curtailed ownership and or use of the Boring Company's flamethrower. That bill has died in the California Assembly's Appropriations Committee. So if you are one of the many people, well, not that many people in California who has sprung for a Boring Company flamethrower that is not actually being called a flamethrower, but rather something like a temperature enhancement device or not a flamethrower. Then California law was did not pass its AB 1949 explosives flame throwing devices. It stalled in committee, so no barrier there. And as I understand it, these things are shipping. In fact, I have a close personal friend who is picking his up tomorrow, and I haven't been keeping track, Victor, too closely on what's going on in the studio. But I suspect that. I mean, if I know my Twit folks, is someone bringing one of these into Twit, Victor?
I don't know. maybe Leo ordered one. I'll look out for a box that size.
Yeah, I'm sure you will. In any event, there is no California law that would prevent you signing for it. So just so you know.
Oh, good to know.
Good to know. and then we have several resources of the week. One is the university in France, where Kim Ellis, our guest today, is an adjunct teacher. It is called the International Space University. You can go there and get, let's see exactly what it's called. It is a master's of some kind in space studies. They have all sorts of different degrees. Here we go. Their programs. A Master of Space Studies. They have a space studies program, they have a Southern Hemisphere program, and they have an executive space course. So if our show here today or just your general interest propels you in more space-oriented ways, this looks like a great place to round out your education and have some credentials to put behind you in pursuing those dreams. Kim, what do you teach there?
Space law and asteroid mining. I do a bunch of cooperative programs, mostly with NASA, but I've done cooperative programs with ESA. We put together our own curriculum, and we get the participants there to work through it. And in fact, the program that I have this year with guys from the NASA Kennedy Space Center, in fact, the International Space Station manager from the Kennedy Space Center, Josephine Burnett, and Tracy Gill from there as well. We did the program last year, and Josephine's going to be doing the program with me this year. Our material that the students feed back to us, actually NASA uses it in their program to inform the next stage of the Mars program that they're doing.
That that's fantastic.
Working with. Yeah, so it's different every year in the space studies program, and they use professionals from all over the world. It's amazing. They even have sponsorships and I can't think of the word.
Fellowships?
So I'll come back. Yeah, scholarships for students to go. Mm-hmm. So it's a wonderful program. 4,000 alumni of the program so far. Peter Diamandis is one of the founders, along with Bob Richards and Todd Hawley.
That's great. And then our other resource is a similar kind of program, shorter. You could do a summer program in space law at Cleveland Marshall College of Law's new Global Space Law Center. So if you want to spend your summer learning more about what we've been discussing today, that would be a good option for you too. I'm going to say a huge thank you and quick farewell to Stefan Spida. No, sorry, I butchered it that time. Spida. Thank you. Thank you so
Thank you very much
for joining us today. Stefan has to run. He has a work thing that we're in danger of making him late for. I've been really, really grateful for you to pinch hit for Mike this week. We'd love to have you back as soon as you can.
Would love to come back. This is a lot of fun, and I really enjoy your show, and very nice to hear your thoughts, Kim. This was, you know, space law is not something I've thought a lot about, and this was super interesting, and I'm now motivated to learn more about it. So thank you for sharing
with us. So awesome.
All right, Stefan, great meeting you. We'll hopefully great catch up with you soon. We'll let you go, and we'll go ahead and bring the car into the garage here without you. Take care.
All right, appreciate it. Thanks so much.
All right. And really with that, all I have left to do is my profuse thanks to Kim Ellis. Thank you so much for reaching out and getting in touch with me and letting me know you're doing what you're doing and for coming on the show today.
Yeah. Absolutely. I really enjoy the opportunity to spread the love on space law.
Yeah, it's a fascinating topic. I think this is our third maybe This Week in Law episode where we've done an all space law or mostly space law show. We love to touch on the topics, but it really, it's a topic that lends itself to having someone who's steeped in it like you come on and bring us up to speed. So we really, really appreciate your having done that today. The feedback we've been getting from the people listening live is off the charts great. So thank you so much.
Awesome. You're very welcome. I look forward to speaking with you again sometime in the future.
We look forward to that too. And we definitely look forward, we hope, to having all of you who've listened to today's show continue joining us every Friday when we do This Week in Law. Now, I say that with an asterisk next to it. We do the show live every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. But you don't have to join us live. It's a podcast. You can subscribe to us in any way, shape, or form that you like. And I have sort of rediscovered the joys of subscribing via iTunes because I'm now driving a car equipped with Apple CarPlay. And that's a really nice way to exploit and use iTunes podcast system, because then all the podcasts you've subscribed to are right there available, you know, on your touchscreen in your car. And I am rediscovering the joys of podcast subscriptions in that way. But you don't have to subscribe. You can go to our twit.tv/twill page. Our entire archive of shows going back to 2006 is there for you to enjoy and listen to at your leisure. You can find our other Space Law episodes there. You can definitely, please do get in touch with us between the shows. I am Denise at twit.tv. Matt is Matt C at twit.tv. Mike Keys is Mike at twit.tv. Please do shoot us emails. Let us know who you think we should invite on the show, other topics you would like to explore, follow-ups on things we've already discussed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Just, you know, a reading list, a sci-fi reading list for Stefan. We definitely need to start putting that together. So anything on your mind, please get in touch with us. Find us on Twitter, find us on Facebook. However you get in touch with, us, please just do and continue to do so. The interaction that we have with our audience is pivotal to being able to do this show. So huge thanks and gratitude from me for that. And once again, Kim Ellis, you've been just a fabulous guest. So excited about the work that you're doing and hope to catch up with you in the not too distant orbital future.
Awesome, Denise. Talk to you then.
All right. Take care.
All right. Ta-da.
Ta-da. Thanks, everyone. Have a great week. We'll see you next week on This Week in Law.